TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Union of Democratic Communications Conference presents Sat Jolly, the 2018 recipient of the Dallas Smythe Award. At a time of Facebook data sales to advertisers and political campaigns, when manipulated media and advertising play an overwhelming role in the selection for political office, there's a renewed focus on organizations that disclose propaganda and deception in the mass media. At the 2018 conference in Chicago, the Union of Democratic Communications honored Sat Jolly for his 3 decades of media activism. Sat Jolly is professor in the communications department at UMass Amherst. His interests include advertising and consumer culture and the intersection of ideology, consciousness, and politics. Jolly is the founder of the Media Education Foundation. MEF produces films that inspire critical reflection on the social, political, and cultural impact of American mass media. On their website at mediaed.org, you can find and possibly recognize films ranging from the commercialization of childhood, the effects of pornography, pop cultural misogyny, and sexism, to titles that deal with the devastating effects of rapacious consumerism and the wars for oil that it drives and the climate change it causes. One film that caused attacks on Sat Jolly and the MEF is The Occupation of the American Mind, Israel's Public Relations War in the United States. The film deals with Israel's 2014 Gaza Strip attack and is narrated by the legendary Roger Waters from Pink Floyd. To this day, the 2016 film that has shown around the world has not been accepted at mainstream film festivals in the U.S. and has no distribution. Sat Jolly received the Dallas Smythe Award. Smythe was a leading scholar in American and international communications policy. During the McCarthy period, he found it difficult to get published. In 1963, he returned to Canada. There he worked at Simon Fraser University as professor of communication until his death in 1992. Here are excerpts from Sat Jolly's one-hour keynote address, recorded on May 12, 2018, in Chicago.
I'm especially happy to get an award in the name of Dallas Smythe. I thought I would give a talk about a project that I think Dallas would have liked and would have approved of. But I hoped he would have liked and would have approved of. So the Media Education Foundation has now been in operation for 28 years. And what I want to stress is that it didn't start off as some grand design. I didn't wake up one day and say, oh, we've got to have some organization that does this. It actually was a response to circumstances. And I guess I want to stress that as a way of being in the world that, you know, very few of us, I mean, we may have plans, but plans don't really work out because you can't predict everything. And so what we're really stuck with are choices. We have choices to make at particular times. We hope we make the right choice. And we often don't. And especially in the left, I don't think we've made the right choices, you know, all the time. But we have choices to make. And the Media Education Foundation actually was formed as a result of some of those choices. So let me tell you just the story. I've only told it once before, actually, in a public form. And it is an interesting story, I think, about how to get independence. My second job after I got my PhD was taught at the University of Massachusetts, and I was teaching large lecture undergraduate classes, which all of us have to do when we start off our careers. So I was teaching a course on media and culture, and I thought, okay, how do you get people who are essentially engulfed in this environment, how do you get them to take it seriously? So, you know, we're all aware of Marshall McLuhan's famous idiom that how do you get the fish to pay attention to the water? We're not too sure who discovered water, but we're pretty sure it wasn't the fish. How do you get people to think about this popular culture that surrounds them everywhere, that has just become the air that we breathe? From my initial perspective was a pedagogical perspective. 300-seat people in front of me, 300 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds who were engulfed in this culture, and I wanted them to take a step back from the culture, that analytical step back, which is absolutely vital to be able to see the world in a new way. Actually, in my classes these days, and a lot of them, I actually start off the semester with a clip, which some of you may be aware, may be familiar with, from the film The Matrix. It's the famous clip where Morpheus is offering Neo a choice between the red pill and the blue pill. And he says to Neo, take the blue pill and you go back to sleep and you're in dreamland and you're back in fantasy. Take the red pill and you're in Wonderland and you'll see how the system operates. And that's what the Matrix is. The Matrix is when you're in the Matrix, how do you get people to see the Matrix? To do that, you've got to take this analytical step back. It's very interesting. It's the one thing they remember from the start of the semester to the end. They actually, in the evaluations, which you all get, they say, I'm really glad I took the red pill. Or sometimes, I wish I hadn't taken it. Ignorance is bliss. I wish I hadn't known. But one of the things we now know is once you know, you cannot unknow. You can't predict what they're going to do with it. Right? That's not our job, by the way. Our job is not to tell people what to do as academics. But that's not our role. Our role is to get people to see the world as clearly as it can be seen, and for them then to make their own ethical and moral choices about how to be in the world. So that was where I started off. This was in 1985, which is a long, long time ago, I realized. And what was central to the culture at that time was MTV. And I thought, well, if you can get people to think about this part of popular culture in an analytical way, then that's a step forward. And one of the major debates at the start of MTV, for those of you who can perhaps remember back that far, actually was a debate about gender. There was a big debate already going on about the very narrow representations of femininity and female sexuality in music video. And so I thought, okay, here's a debate that's going on. Can I get people to think about this in a different way? And so I started to bring in pieces of video. And so that was my first attempt at editing. And eventually, over about 5 years, I produced this standalone piece. I never thought about myself as a filmmaker. I thought about myself as a teacher. I produced this tool that was going to help me in my teaching, try and draw the themes out. And not just that, but what the connection with these images was to sexual attitudes, gender attitudes, and also to sexual violence. And I thought, well, if it's useful to me, it might be useful to some other people. Just so I sent out a very small mailing to other communication departments and to women's studies departments, saying this. And we were selling it for $50, and the money was coming back and going into the department trust fund to cover expenses, etc. So it was very small scale stuff. That all kind of changed in June of 1991, where I got this letter. And it was a cease and desist letter from MTV Networks saying you're using our copyrighted materials, we demand that you stop. When I got this letter, it came both to myself and to the university, because I was a university employee. I was actually kind of shaking when I got it. And I wasn't sure if I was shaking with fear or shaking with excitement. Because I went down, I can't believe what they've done. They've just given me, if I play it right, $1 million worth of publicity. Now, the letter came both to myself and to the president of the university. Right? So it's as a university employee. So I had to deal with the university around this. And lawyers always play it safe. They'll just say, no, don't do it. And so the university lawyer said, we think you're covered by fair use. Right? Actually, what I did was I also wrote to MTV, thanks very much. By the way, here's why it's covered by fair use. And by the way, I noticed that you're running an anti-censorship campaign at this time. kind of ironically. But I had to meet with lawyers. And the lawyer said, we think you're covered by fair use, but we don't want you to do anything. It'll just go away. And I said, that's crazy. So this is a really important moment in which you can make a statement about fair use, you can make a statement about copyright, you can make a statement about academic freedom, you can make a statement about freedom of expression. Why wouldn't a university make this statement? Well, I know why, because universities never make those statements. Never. They never make them when they should make them. And the university lawyers, and they said to me, okay, if you do anything to publicize this, you will no longer be covered by our legal team. You're on your own. So that was the moment at which I had to kind of figure out, I had to decide whether I was going to essentially not do anything or whether I was going to separate myself from the university. And so I decided to separate myself from the university, and that's why MEF was formed. MEF was formed as a response to the control of the university and to separate myself from that. And it was the best decision that I could ever have made. Yeah. Now, what happened was I did send out a press release saying MTV uses copyright law to stifle criticism, free speech at risk. And I got a lot of coverage. This was from the Boston Globe. This was from Newsweek. This might be my major claim to fame. I got George Will off the back of his last page on Newsweek for 1 week. Sorry, so there was a lot of publicity. There was TV stuff, and MEF, you know, we started to distribute the tape. Money came in. We were putting it into other we started putting it into another project, etc. But that was the way it started. The film, we were selling the film. Money was coming in. It was going into other projects. At the early days, it was pretty tough. Our big break was a few years later. I made a connection with Gene Kilbourne, who had done Killing Us Softly 1 and 2. And we did a film with Gene on slimness and advertising. These were materials that were being produced for the classroom. Were being sold to university libraries. And university libraries had a way of getting this material out to classrooms. I did DreamWorlds 2, and this was in 1995. And this led to the kind of first stage of expansion of MEF. So what that decision did was, the decision to separate myself from the university, it gave us independence. It gave me independence. And the fact that we were distributing it to we were distributing it directly meant we weren't going to foundation offices. So that independence is absolutely fundamental to us. And it gave us financial precariousness at the same time. And so in 2004, 2003, we produced what I think was our first kind of political film. And we started to actually branch out beyond the classroom and produce something that we thought actually would work, not just in the classroom, but would work in the community, could work in a theater. And we produced our first film that was really a film that could be shown in theaters, which was called Hijacking Catastrophe. And Hijacking Catastrophe was about the way in which the Bush administration used the tragedy of 9/11 to launch this illegal, insane war in Iraq for this neoliberal agenda of taking over the Middle East. And still one of my favorite films that MEF has done. And the film is about how we were lied into war and about the centrality of propaganda and public relations, of turning Saddam Hussein, who had nothing to do with 9/11, who hated jihadi terrorism, into being connected with 9/11. You wanted to bring it up to modern substitute Assad for Saddam Hussein, and gas attacks, and you'll have the same. This has been going on for a long time, right? This is not exactly rocket science trying to figure out how propaganda works, and it just keeps working all the time. And by the time it's actually figured out, it's too late. Everyone now knows there were no weapons of mass destruction. But politically, it makes no difference. That's one of the things that the presidents and administrations know. Once you start a war, it's impossible to stop it. It doesn't really matter afterwards. You can lie as much as you want. There's actually no difference afterwards. You just got to get into war somehow. The whole economy is built upon that. Then the machine just takes over. We also, at the same time, did a film called Peace Propaganda in the Promised Land. It was the first film we did about Israeli propaganda and why Americans know nothing about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and what they know is all wrong. That was in 2004, so that's also still one of my favorite films. So we've carried on doing this. I'm not going to go through every film that we've done, but the latest film, one of the latest films we've done, I'm not too sure how people in this room will react to this, because the left on this issue is not unified when it should be, but the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a taboo subject in a lot of places. For me, actually, it's one of the major ways I can figure out if someone is really a progressive or not. You can't be progressive on everything else and, you know, turning into a raving Zionist when it comes to Israel. It just doesn't matter. They can't do it. If you're a leftist, you're a leftist because of values. And if you can't see this, if you can't see the Israeli-Palestinian conflict through that, then you're not a leftist. Just be honest. Then you're Rachel Maddow. Right? Then you're... And so for us, this actually is it. That's what independence gave us. It gave us the ability to do a film on something like this. We had to do two films. We just did a film recently, 2016, called The Occupation of the American Mind, where Roger Waters from Pink Floyd is the narrator of it. I mean, one of the great things about this, I get to work with my heroes. Roger Waters is one thing, but also my academic heroes. I include Bob McChesney within this. But I worked with, you know, Edward Said, I've worked with bell hooks, I've worked with a lot of people, and that's just been fun. So this is the challenge we face now with this film. This is actually one of the best films we've done. The blurbs we've got on it have been incredible in terms of what people have said about it, and it has been totally blanked in the U.S. We have not got into any mainstream festival in the U.S. We submitted to every festival, which means we have no media coverage of it. It's been totally blanked by mainstream media. It's got into Palestinian film festivals, as we would expect. It's been shown around the world. It's been shown on Scandinavian TV. Al Jazeera bought and showed it. Russia Today showed it. So around the world, it's actually has gotten. I did a great screening with Roger in Mexico City, where we had two screenings at their National Theater. So around the rest of the world, but in the U.S., it has been. And so what we've decided to do now is we've decided to try and break this, to try and break the suppression. We've decided to do something, might be very foolish, but I've decided to do it. We've decided to give the film away for free. And we are now developing a website where you can watch the film for free in a high-quality mode. You can download it. There's going to be a 20-minute version. There's going to be a 46-minute version of it. And we're going to just try and drive people to the website. So when you hear this, when you get this publicity for this, please share on your social media. And we're not selling anything. We just want people to watch it. We just want people to watch it.
So again and again, we hear the focus-tested phrase that the rockets are raining down on Israel.
We have thousands of rockets raining down on our civilians.
Rockets were raining down on Israel.
Any advertising executive will tell you the essence of propaganda is repetition.
Rockets raining down on southern Israel.
Rockets raining down on Israel.
Well, Hamas rockets rain down on Israeli border towns.
Then Luntz tells PR spokespeople to turn the tables and ask the American people, what would you do?
What sort of question is this? Of course, anybody would act to defend themselves against unprovoked aggression, but it is a question that is completely devoid of any context. What drives a society to a point where after multiple devastating wars, they continue to resist with these most feeble methods? They don't want you to ask that question. They don't want you to ask what is behind this. What's the history here? Who are these people? Where did they come from? Why are they so desperate? No, they want you to understand Israeli behavior. Israeli behavior is always characterized as a reaction to unprovoked violence.
But hopefully in the next month, you'll start to see this. And if you do, as I said, we need just to get it out. Please, please get it out and please, please share. You know, when you do a documentary and it's shown in a theater, the people that come to a theater already figured it out, right? The reason they're willing to spend their $10 or $12 or whatever is they've kind of on board already. The issue of politics is transformation. Now, I believe that we need to produce things for the choir. It's good for the choir to get together. It's good for the choir to feel good. And it's also good to give the choir some resources so they can use it to use in their own work. And for us, that is the notion of translation is absolutely central to that. I'm always looking for new ways to translate difficult abstract material. See, when I watch television, when I'm watching films, in one sense, I'm always watching it as a teacher. I'm always thinking, can I use this? There's someone who spent millions of dollars on this, and can I use it for my own ends? And so let me go back to Dallas Smythe. This is a Dallas Smythe lecture. One of the major things that Dallas insisted upon was the material, productive activity of audiences. And trying to explain that to undergraduates is very, very tough. I actually use the Watching is Working stuff actually to teach Marxist economics to undergraduates without them knowing it's Marxist economics. I understand this is how television works, and then actually you can apply this to the factory. You can apply this to other things as well. But it's very, very difficult. So this is the thing that I wrote with Bill Levant in the Watching Is Working article that we did about Dallas. Again, we say, the modern evolution, sorry, I'm quoting myself, which I don't like doing, but this is, you'll see, the modern evolution of the mass media under capitalism is governed by the appropriation of surplus human objective activity. The development of this appropriation is a higher stage in the development of the value form of capital. Its logic reproduces the logic described by Marx for the earlier form, but its concrete form is in fact a new stage, the value form of human activity itself. The empirical reflection of this is that the process of consciousness becomes valorized. There is thus a partial truth in the label which writers such as Smythe affix to the modern mass media as consciousness industry. Except, and this is what Dallas would not have liked, except that they have so far conceptualized it upside down. It is not characterized primarily by what it puts into you, messages, but by what it takes out, value. Not ideology that it installs in you. That's obviously what it does. But the organization of mass media is around what it takes out of you. It's the same way as in the factory, value is drawn and surplus value is drawn from workers. The same way. How do you explain that? So this is, it's not about what it puts into you, but what it takes out. So I was actually watching the Harry Potter films. There's these monsters in the film called the Dementors. Remember the Dementors? What the Dementors do is they suck your soul from you. Right? That's what the Dementors do. That's what television does. Right? When you talk about translation, you have to be creative. Right? The Dementors are commercial television. They're not trying to put anything into Harry. They're extracting from him his soul. And that's the essence of television. So again, I'm always thinking, this is when I talk about the process of translation, this is, and pedagogy, that this is the project of MEF. I want to finish with, quickly, if I can, the words of someone that I think is most probably not that influential or present in at UDC, and I wish there was more of them. That's the words of Stuart Hall, the great British cultural theorist Stuart Hall. And I know there's been this crazy divide between political economy and cultural studies, and it is crazy because there's no reason for the divide to exist. Stuart talked about the two roles of intellectuals, the Gramscian organic intellectual. Hall is the great scholar of Gramsci. He says, the organic intellectual must work on two fronts at one and the same time. And I think he's talking about us. On the one hand, we had to be at the very forefront of intellectual theoretical work because, as Gramsci says, it is the job of the organic intellectuals to know more than the traditional intellectuals do. Really know. If you are in the game of hegemony, you have to be smarter than them. Hence, there are no theoretical limits from which cultural studies can turn back. We have to go where reality takes us, as complicated and as contradictory as it may be. And it's always going to be complicated and contradictory. And we will need new theoretical tools because the world keeps developing. The world is not the world that Marx looked at in the 19th century. We live in a new world that requires new concepts. And we have to do that intellectual work. That's on the one hand. That's why we have universities, right? But the second aspect is just as crucial, that the organic intellectual cannot absolve himself or herself from the responsibility of transmitting those ideas, that knowledge, through the intellectual function to those who do not belong professionally in the intellectual class. And unless those two fronts are operating at the same time, or at least unless those two ambitions are part of the project of cultural studies, you can get enormous theoretical advance without any engagement at the level of the political project. Okay, that's why that notion of translation is about politics and about making knowledge matter, not just producing knowledge for knowledge's sake. And what Stuart makes is a distinction between academic work and intellectual work. One of the major insults you can give to me is when someone says, oh, he's an academic. It means it's divorced, it's separated. I am in academia, but it's connected to something else, which is the intellectual function. And the intellectual function is a political function. He says, so I'm quoting Stuart very broadly here right now. His words are much better than anything I could say. He says, I come back to the deadly seriousness of intellectual work. It is a deadly serious matter. I come back to the critical distinction between intellectual work and academic work. They overlap, they abut with one another, they feed off one another. The one provides you with the means to do the other, but they are not the same thing. I come back to the difficulty of instituting a genuine cultural and critical practice as a practice which always thinks about its intervention in a world in which it would make some difference, in which it would have some effect. If it isn't about something, why bother? And there's no guarantee. One of the other things that Stuart talked about was there is no guarantee that your intervention in the world will have any effect. If you want a guarantee, speak to yourself. You won't have a guaranteed audience. You'll have a guarantee. Or speak only to people that you agree with. That was Stuart's great phrase, no guarantees. For me, MEF, that's where I am right now. Who knows where I'll be in 5, 10 years' time. But that's the journey that I think I started off when I started off thinking about how to talk to undergraduate students in a way they may understand, and then the MTV stuff. We're now at that boundary, that intellectual dirty boundary. And if MEF is not there, I don't know why we exist. Thanks. I'm finished with what I need to say.
You heard excerpts of Professor Sat Jali's one-hour keynote speech at the Conference of the Union of Democratic Communications. He was recorded by Dale Lehman on May 12 in Chicago. The acronym MEF that Jali is using is the Media Education Foundation that he founded in 1992. Sat Jali is professor in the Communications Department at UMass Amherst. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.